are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In March 2015, Denise Huskins and her boyfriend, Aaron Quinn, awoke from a sound sleep into a nightmare. Armed men bound and drugged them, then abducted Denise. Warned not to call the police or Denise would be killed. Aaron agonized about what to do. Finally put his trust in law enforcement and dialed 911. But instead of searching for Denise, the police accused Aaron of a murder. His story, they told him, was just unbelievable. When Denise was released alive, the police turned their fire on her, dubbing her the real-life Gone Girl, who had faked her own kidnapping. In Victim F, Aaron and Denise recount the horrific ordeal that almost cost them everything. Like too many victims of sexual violence, they were dismissed, disbelieved, and dragged through the mud. With no one to rely on except each other, they took on the victim blaming, harassment, misogyny, and abuse of power running rife in the criminal justice system. Their story is, in the end, a love story, but one that sheds necessary light on sexual assault and the abuse by law enforcement that all too frequently compounds crime victim suffering. Book that we're featuring this evening is Victim F, From Crime Victims to Suspects to Survivors, with my special guests, authors Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. This is an extraordinary and heart-wrenching story. Let's start off with, I know that this book is credited to yourself as authors, but also Nicole Wisensee Egan, and people of the program, listeners might know her from my interview with her discussing her book, Chasing Cosby, and also her podcast. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us Nicole Wisensee's Egan's role in this book, please?
Yeah, I mean, she was a great resource to have in helping us help guiding us in the writing process. We wrote the book from both my perspective and Aaron's perspective, as well as interweaving some third-person perspectives of our family and what was going on with the media and law enforcement. So she was just a really great advocate to have in helping us really share the truth of what happened through our voices, because a lot of our story had been hijacked by the media and with the lies that the police put out.
You start off this book with talking about a little bit about your background before this incredible event in 2014, or pardon me, this incredible event. Let's talk about Aaron, when you first met Denise, what year, and tell us a little bit about your move from move to Northern California.
Yeah, I was working in neurological rehab as a physical therapist in the city of Vallejo, where I met Denise in the summer of 2014. During that time, or prior to me and Denise, I had broken up with my ex-fiance due to her infidelity. So when we met, I was in a tough situation. I was reeling from that past relationship. But we immediately connected just for our love for therapy, and we have similar families, and just became a very easy conversation. So we quickly fell in love. And up to that point of the home invasion, we had kind of reached a crossroads of our relationship as I needed to move forward or move past my ex. And so we ended up having a very emotional talk that night. We decided that we were going to commit each other, and we went to bed around midnight, and we were content on the starting over, and then all this chaos happened.
Around 3 a.m. that morning, you write, what happened while you were asleep? What happened to rouse you from your sleep, both of you?
Yeah, so I was in a deep sleep and was woken to a strange man's voice repeating the phrases over and over, wake up, this is a robbery, we are not here to hurt you. At first, I thought it was a nightmare, but when my eyes popped open, I saw flashing white light against the wall and multiple red laser dots scanning. So we knew that they were armed and there was a few people in there. I was instructed to tie up Aaron, and zip ties were left at the edge of the bed. I tied him up. I was then tied up in the closet. We were given blacked out swim goggles to blindfold us and headphones that played these pre-recorded messages of instruction. We were eventually forced to take a sedative. And as the night went on, things just got worse and worse, and we realized it's not a robbery. And I was told that I would be taken for 48 hours, where Aaron would have to complete some tasks for my return.
What was part of these intruders' instructions, well, not instructions, but some of the things that they said in terms of monitoring you?
Yeah, the kidnappers had set up constraints to enforce my compliance. So one of them was putting a mirroring app on my phone, which would allow them to see my text messages or outgoing calls. They also had set up my house as a home prison where they had put a camera that would give them live feed of what I was doing, and I needed to stay within the confines of that camera's view. The threats were, if I went to the police, they would kill Denise. If I didn't comply, they would hurt Denise. Or, just as important, they would hurt my family, as they knew where my parents had lived.
They also said that they talked about your ex-girlfriend, Jennifer. What was it that they asked regarding Jennifer and Denise?
There was a moment at the beginning of the home invasion, Denise and I were in my master closet, but they eventually separated the two of us. And at one moment, the person that we called the voice came back to the closet and asked me if Denise and my ex, Jennifer, look alike. And I gave out a long, guttural sigh, and I said, yes, they both have long, blonde hair. He replied that this was intended for my ex, and they got the wrong intel, and they needed to decide what they're going to do next, which we had hoped maybe they would just leave because they hadn't seen their faces. They had covertly got in, and because it wasn't intended for Denise, maybe they'll let us go. Unfortunately, they came back and told me that they were going to take Denise for 48 hours because they believed it would be good practice for their group, which was a black market operation that could get people personal and financial debts, or people could hire for personal and financial debts. So they were going to take Denise, practice their protocols, and I would need to pay money, and the $17,000 to get her back.
And how did they make these arrangements? What were their planned arrangements to be able to get this money?
Yeah, so the kidnappers had been stalking me for at least a half a year. Part of the reason why they said they confused Denise and my ex was that months ago they had found a piece of mail addressed to my ex-fiance, and that tells us that they had been my house long before, because the mail had stopped at least half a year before this. They actually knew my financial records. They knew where I banked. They knew my Social Security number. And so at this point, I had about $20,000 in my bank account at the time. And so they wanted two payments of $8,500 to maintain or to stay under the mandated federal reporting limit. In turn, I think it's a fairly smart design because they wanted this to be a self-contained 48-hour event. You know, obviously, if they asked for any amount of money, I would have given them it to get Denise back. But if they asked for a couple million dollars, one, I don't have it, and two, that would require a lot more paperwork. So in turn, they wanted something, quick access to money, and then get away with it.
Did they talk about their operation whatsoever?
Yeah.
At one point.
Go ahead, Aaron.
Go ahead, Denise. Yeah, that's fine.
I was just going to say, and when I was in captivity, that's when the man who was with me during that 48 hours, he would describe what that organization was, and the same thing Aaron said about it being a black market startup company that someone could hire to fulfill personal or financial debts. They had said they'd done this before, and you know, they are really sophisticated in technology and the psychological effects of victims. And so, you know, they, even after the release, they'll know if the victim appears to be wanting to speak to the police and have taken measures to prevent that from happening, like threatening a family member. And I mean, there was a lot of things along the way that just indicated how well thought out and planned this was. It was quite obvious that that they knew what they were doing, and that they would follow through with any of those threats.
With this, with Denise going to be kidnapped and separated from you, and you even heard the car start up, and you say even the trunk being closed. How did they? How did this group tell you that they were going to plan for you to comply? What were those assurances for them that you would comply with their orders while they took Denise for this 48 hours?
So they had installed a mirroring app on my phone that would allow them to see my text messages and phone calls, and then they also had installed a camera that would allow them to see me within my home. I was instructed to keep the blinds shut if anyone tried to come to my house and need to redirect them, and they were also going to monitor me when I went to the bank. So they had taken Denise in my car, but they had told me that they would transfer her to a different car. In the morning, they would give me instructions on where to find my car. We found out later that they had a high-powered drone. They had put red tape on top of my car that would allow them to follow me with a drone as I went to the bank.
Now, given the warnings that they gave you not to contact police and that you were being monitored, you believe that they were watching you constantly. What did you decide to do and why?
As one of the perpetrators brought me down to my living area where I was supposed to stay for the 48 hours, as we're crossing the kitchen tile, electronic dung sound coming from the corner. And I knew right away if that sound kept going for 48 hours that I would lose my mind. And I asked them if it would continue to make that noise the entire time. And then he made a mistake of saying that they weren't allowed to get into my router, or they were unable to get into my router. In turn, they were loading the camera through Wi-Fi. And by the morning, that sound should stop once the camera's fully loaded. However, I had passed out due to the sedative after they had taken Denise. Eventually, I was able to stay awake by 11:30 that morning, and the camera continued to make that noise whenever I moved. Finally, the kidnappers, as they were communicating through text messages and emails, said that I would drop the money off Tuesday night, and they returned Denise Wednesday morning. And I started thinking that if I came with the money, they would take me as well and kill us both. And that the camera continued to make that noise, so maybe it wasn't operating fully, and I needed to risk gain help because I can't trust these guys anymore. And that's when I thought 911 wasn't an option because they could still probably see what if I was making phone calls. So I called my brother, who's an FBI special agent. And I made a decision that I could lie and have my brother was supposed to come over and maybe avoid any serious harm to Denise. My brother told me to call 911 because they needed we needed the full force of law enforcement behind us to help find Denise. And unfortunately, the police made everything worse.
Yes, you write about that immediately after you tell your story to police, you recognize that they are believing and accusing you of killing Denise, and they're talking in that way, aren't they?
Yeah, the police were accusatory from basically the start. I always knew that they would look at me as a suspect. They should. I'm the last person to see Denise. I didn't realize that I was going to be the only suspect. And they stripped me down, put me in prison clothes, took pictures of me naked, kept me in an interrogation room with no clock, no access to the bathroom without them watching, separated from my family. And so for the next 18 hours, they aggressively interrogated me, saying that the story I was saying was too bizarre to be believable, and they know I killed Denise, and I can either say it's an accident, or if I keep denying it, they'll paint me as a cold, calculated monster.
And meanwhile, you are absolutely concerned about Denise, and also feeling guilty that you've made this decision to call police, contrary to what the abductors had cautioned you not to do.
I knew once I called the police that the clock was ticking. I mean, the clock was already ticking once he took took her in my car. So I was in this impossible situation. I'm trying to convince the police to investigate and try to save her while they're aggressively going after me. So I can't alienate them because I need their help. But also, I don't want to be in that room being psychologically tortured as well. Difficult to describe unless you've been in there, but they are trained professionals trying to get a confession because they were convinced that I had killed her. There was no other option. And in turn, we found out later that they had evidence and phone calls that would have led them to Denise that day, but they ignored all of it.
Now, Denise, while Aaron is worried and Aaron is in now being questioned like he's a suspect, take us to what happens to you. You're on this car ride. Tell us how they keep you unaware of where you are and not able to identify your what you call the voice, the person that has abducted you. Tell us about your ordeal and what happens when you get to the location.
Yeah, so I when I was placed in the trunk of the car, I was still blindfolded and bound. Also, the sedatives we were forced to take were starting to kick in. They had me in the trunk of a car for hours to where my body became numb and I was in and out of consciousness. So I, you know, by the time we got to the location where we were at, I knew, you know, it had been hours, but couldn't be sure how many. Any time in that next 2 days the voice would come in, I had to be blindfolded. So I never saw him, you know, but he, the first day had said, because this wasn't meant for me, they didn't have any information on me to hold against me. And so it was decided that one of them, him, would have to have sex with me and it would have to be recorded. So that way in the event of my release, if they thought I was going to speak to the police, they would release it on the internet. And again, because of that, it needed to look semi-consensual. That first assault, I still had these blacked out swim goggles on and thought this is not going to look consensual. And of course, the next day he said it, you know, the video footage wasn't good enough or believable enough. So the next time he taped my eyes shut and said I had to perform in a way that made it seem like we were a couple, and I had to get a kiss, and I had to do and say things. And so I did, because I, one, didn't want it to happen again, and two, they had complete power over me. So I knew it was going to happen one way or another, and I was just trying to minimize the violence and the trauma of it all. But, you know, in the end, he did release me. By the end of that 48 hours, he told me that Aaron had gone to the police and the media was reporting it, but it didn't scare them or worry them. They thought it would be good PR for the group that they're able to, you know, fulfill this quote-unquote mission without harming the victim. The whole time in the 2 days of captivity, I kept telling him, I believe that you're going to kill me. And I was making peace with the end of my life. And so I was in shock that he actually did follow through with releasing me.
You were finally released, and you didn't know, even though he kept assuring you that they were not to hurt you, he would not hurt you, he had those assurances that you would not be hurt, you were finally released. We won't go into the circumstances when you were released and how the police get to you right away, but suffice to say that when you speak to police, now that they had accused Aaron of your kidnap and murder, now that police realize that you are free, you recount your story to them. What is their response to your story once you've been released?
Yeah, well, it was clear later on, because the second day of captivity, I was forced to record a proof of life. And by the way, when I was still in captivity, the way that the police spoke to my family and the types of questions that they had, they even mentioned the Gone Girl thing. It was clear, just because I was alive, that they believed that this was a hoax. So before even me being released, it was clear that was a decision. I was released in my hometown in Huntington Beach, California. And I spoke to the local police within an hour or so. I was at a neighbor of my dad's, and I told them about the home invasion and the kidnapping. And the whole time I'm speaking to them, I'm worried about what might be released publicly, especially as media was gathering outside. Because before I was let go, the voice had said, you know, you're going to have to speak to the police. Aaron went to the police. You can tell them about what happened, except you can't say that any one of us is in the military or anything about the sexual assaults. And so I had that kind of weighing over me as I was speaking to Huntington Beach police. At the end of it, the first contact that I had with a Vallejo police detective, Matt Mustard, he told a family member that he didn't believe me. He was going to be offering me immunity, and he was going to offer it to me and Aaron, whoever took it first would get it. And so that was indication that I needed a criminal defense attorney to help protect me.
What about the FBI's involvement in this? I talked about Vallejo PD and Matt Mustard, but how and why did the FBI get involved? And who do you both get to speak to in that regard?
During my interrogation, I was told that because of adult kidnapping for ransom, that the FBI would be involved. And this was maybe 12 hours after I had gone to the Vallejo police. They asked at one point for me to take a polygraph. to eliminate me as a suspect, which I agreed to, mainly, I think, because I was sleep deprived and traumatized. A special agent, Peter French, administered the polygraph, which he said I had failed miserably, and again went on the fact that I killed Denise. Later on, a couple other FBI agents get involved, and one of them ends up questioning Denise but doesn't question me. I'll let her take up from here.
Yeah, so once I obtained a criminal defense attorney, we decided that I was going to go in for questioning because that was the only way to potentially capture these terrorists. And I didn't want this to happen to anyone else. And I was told by my defense attorney, you know, the FBI is going to be involved. And I thought, okay, great. You know, maybe this is just a bad decision making from local police department. The FBI has a lot of resources. Aaron's brother is an FBI agent. It'd be great. But they treated me the same way and threatened me with prosecution. And that lead FBI agent who questioned me at the end of the questioning told my attorney he was 99% sure I was lying and that my attorney should watch the movie Gone Girl. It would help explain a lot. About 6 or so weeks later, as Aaron and I are talking and going, you know, why were we questioned by different people? And I couldn't remember the guy's name. And when we discovered what his name was, Aaron remembered that his ex, who was the intended target of this kidnapping, had had a prior relationship with this lead FBI agent. And it was never disclosed to either one of us or our attorneys.
Interesting. Let's stop for a second for these messages. Now, you mentioned this Jennifer, your ex, Jennifer, had dated an FBI agent, and then you just mentioned, Denise just mentioned, that she was interviewed by an FBI agent and didn't put two and two together till later. Tell us about Dave Sesma and more about this seeming conflict of interest, and then you talk about your lawyer, Denise, making a formal complaint to the FBI about this. So tell us about what happens with this complaint and this investigation now that there's someone else to look at seriously.
I mean, we, finding this out, we're like, well, this is, I mean, this is outrageous. You know, I mean, at the very least, this is, this conflict of interest is, could potentially bias his investigation. And it was clear for months after the kidnapping that their sights were only on Aaron and me. And so we tell this to the federal prosecutor to let him know. And then, yeah, my defense attorney writes Department of Justice, and we're trying to get people to realize that we need new investigators on this case if they ever have a chance in catching these criminals. And it was essentially all ignored and dismissed or saying, you know, it's not our problem. And in the meantime, the kidnappers were free to hurt more people. And in fact, the one who held me captive and raped me was then caught just a few months after my kidnapping by a different police department for terrorizing another family. And it was just really devastating to find out that the only way that the truth came out was because they were free to attack other people.
You write about your SART, your sexual assault exam, and your treatment by staff and police regarding your allegation that you were sexually assaulted. Tell us a little bit about this ordeal of yours.
Yeah, well, once I spoke to my criminal defense attorney and told him how I was threatened not to mention the sexual assault, he had said, you know, if you speak to police, you have to let them know. You can't let these people have power over you. And the first thing we need to do is get you to the hospital. So when he was calling the police to try to get an exam scheduled right away, the response was, you know, how do we know she was raped? And, you know, we'll wait to set up the exam until she comes in and talks to us. And that I needed to keep my clothes on and not shower, not wash my hands or brush my teeth. And I had to essentially wait another 24 hours. I had to go in and prove to them that the exam was worth setting up. And the whole time, you know, I'm terrified that the decision to talk to the police is going to not just hurt me, but my family, because my family was threatened. And two, I had told them that based on the defenseless position I was in, I didn't fight. They weren't violent, quote unquote, violent assaults. The whole time I'm in the exam, you know, my legs open and being examined internally, I'm wondering, you know, is my body going to betray me? Should I have fought and made this more obvious that it's a rape? And sure enough, later in the FBI affidavit for the arrest of Matthew Mueller, it says in the affidavit that there was no signs of non-consensual sex, which again discounts the fact that I was raped. I do want to say, though, that the nurses who did perform the START exam were really kind and respectful, and I didn't ever feel judgment or bias from them, and they were really helpful. So it wasn't necessarily the staff, but it was law enforcement that really re-victimized me.
Talking about re-victimization, Aaron, I'll ask you first. Right away when you were released from questioning, what was the media response? Tell us a little bit about the police press conferences that they held. Tell us about the media response and what the police said at those media conferences.
Yeah, so Denise was released Wednesday morning and spoke to the local police at Huntington Beach. Then was offered immunity to say the whole thing was made up. During that time period, I was also offered by the police immunity to say the whole thing was made up as well. And then later that night, so by 9:30 that night, you know, just less than 12 hours after Denise was released and without speaking to her directly, the Vallejo police with Lieutenant Kenny Park went and held a press conference, and he declared the whole thing a wild goose chase and that we had wasted valuable resources from the community and instilled fear into the community and that we owed the public an apology. And unfortunately, the media just ran with that statement and didn't question law enforcement's betrayal and repeated their not repeated, but amplified their false claims. And in turn, Denise was labeled a real-life gone girl. The case went international news, and our reputations were destroyed in an instant. And if it wasn't for the fact that Matthew Mueller attacked another family and the Dublin police did their job, our reputations would have never been restored. And again, one of the real tragedies, another family got attacked. So police misconduct makes the public unsafe. Not only hurts the victims, but also hurts the community as a whole.
What we haven't spoken about, and I guess we won't have full time to explore, but it's the police pressure on you and Denise. When they talk about this offer, immunity, well, only one of you is going to get it. All along this time, you have, when Denise speaks about finally attorney Doug Rappaport believing her story, that's what you have for an extended period of time. Only family believes your story. Almost everyone else believes that this is a concocted story, don't they?
Yeah, we are fortunate. We have the financial means to hire lawyers like Doug Rappaport and Dan Russo and Amy Morton. We spent about $140,000 on criminal defense attorneys, and we weren't even charged with a crime. fortunately for us, they really advocated for us and believed our account, partly because Denise and I were, our details of the home invasion matched perfectly. And for two people to come up with that crazy of a story that matches would be almost impossible, and that's something law enforcement should have known as well. So during this time, we had a great safety net as far as our family and our close friends who believed us, but otherwise our jobs were looking to fire us. We couldn't work just because of trauma, but even if we wanted to, we weren't able to. And we just were kind of nomads, just with each other and our family, in a real desperate situation, trying to figure out how we're ever going to get out of this deep and dark hole.
How did Attorney Rapoport fare with the FBI making the complaint about Dave Sesma and this magnificent conflict of interest being able to interview Denise? What comes of this investigation that he tries to bring to the FBI to investigate their own?
Really nothing comes of it. That was, you know, the difficult part about all of this is you can kind of wrap your head around people who are motivated to cause harm and terrorize, but you think, you know, there's law enforcement that's going to help you, that you can turn to, and just step by step, every bit of the way, it was just one blow after another, it was just this great disappointment, especially knowing how good law enforcement can be. You know, Aaron's brother is an FBI agent, and his colleagues that he worked with, you know, they do incredible work, and they're really intelligent. And so it was just deeply disappointing that that all of this occurred, and then there was no accountability. There was nothing changed. It was the same investigators on the case throughout. And so we as victims who have really no power to investigate are just sitting there going, okay, I guess this is what we're stuck with.
During this, what is the status of your relationship? I know that you were separated for a fair amount of time and that you had that difficult conversation before this home invasion ever occurred. What was your relationship like during this ordeal?
I mean, our bond just grew stronger. You know, our connection when we first met and first started hanging out was just, it was instant. I mean, if you think of what a soulmate is and could be, we've felt that with each other. You know, so we are perhaps in a rare position of going through a trauma like this where we were able to work through it. And a big part of that too is that we never blamed each other for any of it. And have a unique understanding for what each other's going through as far as PTSD, and, you know, having our names and reputations being dragged through the mud. We also have really strong, you know, family support and a core group of friends that I think all of that combined helped strengthen our relationship.
Let's talk about this home invasion in South Lake Tahoe. Give us some of the details that you were aware of, and this is in Dublin, California.
Yeah, and so in the middle of the night, an intruder came into the house, a family's home in Dublin, and had a similar MO of waking him to a gun with a red laser sight. This time, however, the intruder said, "Your daughter is safe," to the father, and was close enough that the father decided to fight back, where in our scenario, the kidnappers set zip ties on the bed and stood, you know, 10 to 15 feet away. During that struggle, the wife was able to get her phone and call 911, and the a home invader fled, but he left his personal cell phone, which the police were able to track to Matthew Moeller, and then Matthew Moeller in South Lake Tahoe, which matched the location of where Denise was held. And in South Lake Tahoe, they found evidence that connected him to our crime as well. So my laptop was there. Denise's, the address where the kidnappers dropped Denise off was in the car's GPS, and they eventually found the recordings of the sexual assault at in that South Lake Tahoe home.
What was the conversation like once the FBI realized that what you would, both had said was the absolute truth? What was that conversation like?
The FBI didn't contact us until about 3 weeks after this Dublin invasion. It was, I think, more than a week after they knew that Moeller had was connected to our crime. They basically told us that they ran with this case and there was no way to solve it. We found out later that the kidnappers had been calling my phone, and they had triangulated these three phone calls to South Lake Tahoe within 200 square meters of the house. So they had this evidence for months and sat on it and did nothing. And unfortunately, there hasn't been accountability or their, you know, conflict of interest and their sheer lack of basic police work. And so we're, as Dean said, we were left with the same investigators who said I killed her and the same investigators of the hoaxer, and they haven't, they really haven't course corrected.
What was the media response to this new information, clashed with the information that they've been releasing for all this time?
Well, you know, for the most part, the media coverage changed in our favor. And, I mean, I don't know. I guess in a way, there was a lot of blame to the Vallejo police. How could they have messed this up? There was also a lot of responsibility from the media that they could have asked the appropriate questions early on, and could have minimized some of the trauma that we had gone through. But at least now things were shifted in our favor and the truth was out. Yet still, you know, you plant that seed of doubt, and there's certain people in the public that still blamed us, and in particular me, you know, thought I might have still been involved in some way, or said that I was shady, or, you know, still reached out and sent hateful messages. In time, that's gotten less and less. But yeah, I mean, there's still people who refuse to accept that they were wrong about their belief of us.
One of our civil attorneys described that as a verbal tattoo, and I think that's an accurate portrayal of what happened.
Before we talk about that civil action, legal action, what about Matthew Moeller's plea deal? What about his legal situation? How was it dealt with?
So he pled guilty to federal crime and has received a 40-year sentence. Currently, he's also being charged at the state level, which is a pending case. I think for us, we know that he is a dangerous individual, and we just don't want him to hurt anyone else again. Maybe more importantly, we were able to speak at the victim statement and actually be able to have our voices heard through us, not through our attorneys or through the media. And that was an empowering situation. And I'll let Denise talk about her experience during the victim statement.
I mean, for me to finally look, you know, my captor and rapist in the eye, because anytime I was with him, I was blindfolded, and, you know, he did what he wanted with my body and my life. So for me to see him face to face and have him really see me, and it was empowering. And not only him, but we had, you know, the whole courtroom was full of our friends and our family, and then also a lot of reporters who had initially been reporting the lies that the police gave. So it was helpful to have everyone see us. You know, we weren't just a story or a headline. We're real people that were suffering.
What about the idea of the civil, of a civil lawsuit? Tell us about that.
So we ended up suing the city of Vallejo and Detective Mutchern and Kenny Park and the chief for defamation and false imprisonment, another violation of due process. You know, fortunately, we would like to have seen some sort of change within the department, but they haven't shown any interest in policing themselves or holding themselves accountable. And, you know, public attention and civil lawsuits are a way to create pressure and change. We were able to reach a settlement for $2.5 million with the city in 2018.
Wow.
But even during this civil process, Vallejo kept doubling down on that it was just too bizarre of a story to be believed, or they said Denise didn't act like a victim, despite wow. saying depositions that they're trained that no victims act the same. And the Detective Mutcher lied in a sworn statement as well, saying that Denise refused to talk to police, which was categorically untrue. So they have continued this lack of accountability. The city council has continued to insulate and protect them. And unfortunately, the Vallejo police have a terrible relationship with the community and a poor track record. And we're hoping maybe even pressure from the book and that they'll make something they'll improve, because the community deserves better, and the good officers within there and that department deserve better as well.
How did they explain that Dave Sesma was able to question Denise? Did they ever answer that?
No. And on top of that, my brother had sent the internal affairs report, and the response was that Agent Sesma disclosed his relationship with the prosecutor, and the prosecutor deemed it wasn't important, even though that is not actually the process.
Wow.
Sesma needed to actually disclose it to a supervisor, although he's an acting supervisor for his regional agency at the time. So we don't know if we haven't been shown that he disclosed it in any sort of proper manner. And unfortunately, he's also been promoted during this time period as well.
Jeez, wow. Was there any official word from Jennifer about any of this?
No, and I think some of the problems, or what happens in our case, is where there's a lot of questions without answers, and that's not unique to victims. You know, many people have a trauma happen to them, and then you can't find, as desperate as you want to find the answers, they're not going to be there. So for us, it's more about moving forward with the pillars that are important to us, and that would be our relationship. We were married in 2018. We have a beautiful daughter who was born exactly 5 years to the date of Denise's release. And we're able to get back to being physical therapists and helping people, which is part of the reason why we fell in love with each other in the first place. And we're hoping that the book will be another way to help at a larger scale.
And what about your work at this Kaiser clinic? And what about the job that you were about to start? And again, as a therapist, Denise, what about that work? What about that future?
Yeah, I mean, I was at Kaiser in Vallejo to specialize in the neurological population. So I was there for a 9-month residency, and that was literally just finishing up that week that I was kidnapped. But there was a job opening in a nearby town that I could potentially transfer to and stay in the Kaiser system, because there was also another fellowship of training that was going to be a year and a half long that I was applying to as well. So basically, all, you know, everything just went away. And I was eventually able to there was one exam left for the residency I was in. I was finally able to schedule it, but I wasn't allowed to go into the hospital to take it. I took it out in essentially a trailer next to the hospital. But I completed it. It took me a year to build up the courage to try to start working again. I was afraid that people would see me as a liar and hoaxer and wouldn't trust me with their care. You know, we literally put our hands on people to help promote healing and rehabilitation. And who would trust me if they think of me like that? But, you know, we both were able to start working in a different way, and we moved out of town. And so now we're back to doing what we love. And in some ways, the trauma of the kidnapping and the assaults have helped me dive deeper with some of my patients, not only the physical trauma that they endure, but the emotional, psychological component and how that affects the body.
And what is the message that you have, both of you, Aaron and Denise, for people that read this book? What is the overall message? What would you like to impart to people that read this book?
I think above anything, there is hope. You know, I mean, you could go through the unimaginable where, you know, you're dealing with trauma, and at some points you feel like, I mean, I'm never going to get past this. This is hopeless. There is still hope. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. And if you're still struggling, I think us sharing our story and hearing from other survivors, it really does help give you strength to keep fighting.
Anything that you would like to impart, Aaron, from this story?
Yeah, the other part of what we liked, why we told it from our point of view, from Denise's point of view and myself, is to walk people through our experience as victims and, as we say, transition to survivors. I hope as people read this book, maybe they pause the brake on rushing to judgment when they see a story or they see a headline, because you don't really know the whole story. And I think there's an opportunity now with social media to send real hurt and hate to people with very little consequences, with the person typing it out who's going through something bad. And you don't need to throw stones. It's okay to say, I don't know. It's okay to pause. And we're hoping that we provide a little empathy and compassion to this world by sharing our experience.
Yes, it certainly is a fantastic example of, again, not rushing to judgment, especially considering this dramatic end to the story with this Mahler being convicted and having all this evidence right at that crime scene, too. It really must have been hard for you to realize that it took that event, it took that extraordinary effort and that extraordinary event to be able to prove your innocence finally.
Yeah, we're in many ways, we're actually the fortunate ones. There's estimated over 200,000 innocent people in prison in the U.S. system. There are many miscarriages of justice. We were fortunate that ours actually was turned around within months instead of years or decades or ever. But it did take a massive break and some luck and quality police work from Dublin and from Detective Misty. And without her, I don't know where we would be. And there's awful police work by the FBI and Vallejo police, but on the opposite end, there's great work by Detective Carolusu, and she is a real hero of ours and was at our wedding and at our baby shower, and we're very lucky to have her in our lives.
Yeah, incredible. You write, too, that she was a brand new detective. It wasn't even going to be a detective to the next day. So it was incredible, the extraordinary effort that she did do in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to thank you both for coming on and talking about Victim F, from crime victims to suspects to survivors. Can you tell us if there's a Facebook page or where they might find out more information about this book and this case?
Yeah, there's a Facebook page under the same title, Victim F, and they can also find more about us and where to purchase the book at victimf.com.
Yes. Thank you so much, Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn. This has been extraordinarily compelling interview. Thank you so much. Victim F, from crime victims to suspects to survivors, Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.